Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is Legislative Counsel to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Ernesto Falcone. Ernesto, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's nice to have you on the show, guys, because net neutrality is something I wanted to ask you about, and you're an expert on that. For the listeners, you are the Legislative Counsel at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, with a primary focus on intellectual property and open internet issues. And you are at the forefront of issues like net neutrality, which is heavy on all of our minds right now. So let's talk about all that. But before we do that, I wanted to ask you, as we do on Background Mode, how you got into law. That's always an interesting process.
Sure. So, I worked actually for a number of years before I went back to law school. Right after I graduated college, I flew out to New Hampshire to work on a presidential primary. This is in 2003, and this is for Howard Dean. He was a Democratic candidate, strong anti-war stance, and that was something that really attracted me, you know, at that time. And I was a political science major, a minor in psych, but I knew my way around computers. All my friends were engineers. I knew how to put my own computer together just as a means to kind of save money to upgrade.
Nice.
Yeah, and so that was like my in. I was technical support for a political campaign, and eventually found my way to Congress from a friend who suggested I go there next, and if I want to work in this space, you know, technology policy generally. So I spent about 6 years in Congress, and then joined an organization called Public Knowledge. They're a nonprofit based in D.C. that does broadband competition and copyright policy.
Can I ask you about your time in Congress before we move on?
Oh, certainly.
What were you doing as a legislative staffer? What does that involve?
So a legislative staffer, what you do really is you're trying to manage the relationships that the congressman builds back home with the constituents. So we handle almost all the kind of correspondence. When you write a letter to a member of Congress, there's not just the member of Congress themselves that look at it or write the response, but there's a staffer who really handles 90% of that load and then gets the sign off. And so that's a big part. And the other part is navigating the legislative portfolio you're granted. So each staffer is given a handful of issues that the member of Congress wants to put energy into and kind of change the law or change where government money gets spent to move a policy issue.
Did that work inspire you or involve things that you would later pay attention to?
Oh, absolutely, actually. I was in Congress when the former CEO of AT&T, Ed Whitaker, made this grand announcement at the National Association of Regulatory Commissioners, NARUC is the organization, that no one's allowed to ride over our pipes for free. If you're going to ride our pipes, you have to pay money. Kind of breaking the understanding that, you know, most people in D.C. had about how the internet was functioning, which was people were able to connect and then, you know, service a product, and there wasn't any sort of middle person saying, you know, setting up a toll road or asking you to pay extra money in order to actually make that connection with other people.
Isn't it true that the National Science Foundation turned the internet backbone over to a couple of key companies with that expectation?
Well, I don't think it was necessarily with that expectation. I think the expectation has always been that the routing of data would be treated kind of robotically, right? And that's the essence of net neutrality, in that the network has always operated as this kind of open platform where the destination and the content of the information really had no relevance to how it was moved. And that's been the underwriting, you know, the theory of the network and the internet. Things changed as the ISPs grew more sophisticated, they grew larger, and their reach into more products, particularly in content, grew. You know, that's where you start getting the more adversarial position of the largest ISPs against network neutrality. But it was really, around 2005 when the AT&T CEO, you know, says this famous line in the speech. And suddenly, and Congress is simultaneously considering legislation on updating what's called franchising, this process where when a cable company would sell a product to a city, they need to negotiate with the mayor's office and the city council to, you know, which neighborhoods are allowed to distribute their cable lines to. This is traditionally what franchising has been. Verizon wanted to change all of that for deploying Verizon Fios, their fiber optic product. And they wanted to get rid of local power, kind of take away power from cities and consolidate it all at the state level with the governor's executive branch, usually with the state's utility commissioner. So that was the original point of this bill that was moving through Congress fairly easily. And then everyone started asking questions like, oh, wait, what are we doing to make sure the network stays neutral? What are we doing to make sure that you can't block, you can't throttle, you can't engage in what's called pay prioritization, the idea that if you pay a toll, you'll get preferential treatment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These were all the initial questions that were coming up in 2005. And I think at that time, most politicians were fairly uncertain about what to do. But then a very, kind of the same, active group of elected officials that exist today that were there, 10 plus years ago, immediately felt that the law has to affirmatively state that the network would remain neutral.
Senator, did any laws to that effect get passed?
No. So what ended up happening was the bill that was to change franchising power for Verizon ended up dying on net neutrality because it got out of the House of Representatives and then it couldn't muster the requisite number of votes to make it out of the Senate Commerce Committee because then Senator Olympia Snowe joined with the Democrats to support a network neutrality provision that the large ISPs did not want at all within any sort of legislation. And so at that point, there was no way to move the bill forward.
So these are the beginnings of the idea that the consumers are not in charge. The companies get to call the shots, I guess.
Yeah, I think the beginning of the awakening to that danger is what it is. Because I think prior to this point, everyone from a policymaking standpoint, folks felt generally, were unaware, right, of that danger. The interesting thing is what ended up happening afterwards is a lot of states changed their franchising laws, but the issue of net neutrality remains, heavily contested, at least within DC, not so much with the public. I think the public overwhelmingly supports the law to support net neutrality, but within DC and kind of the insider game, particularly when you take in, campaign contributions and the political influence, it remains close, very divided.
So I saw in your bio that you fought against the merger of AT&T and T-Mobile. Was that based on philosophical grounds and monopoly principles, or did it have something to do with net neutrality as well?
It's kind of all of the above. So when I was at Public Knowledge, I was their first person to lobby Congress on behalf of the consumer group. They didn't have anyone that did that type of work, and it was fairly new for the nonprofit. And, so our job really then was to think about what's the consumer's benefit and what's good for consumers and is there any advantages to, decisions being made at the FCC or in Congress. So when AT&T announced its merger with T-Mobile, we already have a very concentrated market in the first place. And the wireless market's fairly top heavy with AT&T Verizon for the most part. And the idea that you get rid of one of the two remaining viable competitors to the major companies, there is no good policy grounds to say that would be a good outcome for people. At the end of the day, what it probably would have resulted in is Verizon and Sprint trying to figure out how to merge themselves in order to have equal weight with the new mega company. Right. And if you didn't put a stop to it at that point, after how many mergers you've already had in the wireless space, you've had several by this point. I don't know how old the listener is, but there was a time where I had Singular Wireless. They were bought up and they're gone.
I've seen a family tree somewhere in the internet in my past. I've seen a family tree of all the Baby Bells and all the different wireless carriers and the names and Singular and U.S. West and how they all merged. And there's this line gets bigger and bigger going to the right. I wish I could find that chart again. You probably have it.
I know exactly the chart you're talking about. I look for it too. I mean, Chairman Cole, former senator from, I believe, Wisconsin, was the chair of the antitrust subcommittee. And he labeled the hearing as Humpty Dumpty putting himself back together again. Because that's exactly what was happening in the telecom market, which is, the government broke all these companies up for a purpose. And now they're slowly merging, you know, merging and reforming into one major company. So net neutrality obviously is a major issue in the sense of in the context of that merger, because when you own so many of the lines, your leverage over all content is dramatic. You know, you can decide who wins, who loses just by your size of your market share. But the real major issue for consumers was they were going to end up paying more for less quality, less options, and the innovation was essentially going to suffer. Because once you're a dominant player and you don't have to worry about competition, you have no reason to invest in your network. You have no reason to roll out new products or you'll lower your prices in the long term with new services.
I read that you also fought against SOPA. I vaguely remember what that was. There was a lot of energy against it. You worked on that. What was SOPA trying to achieve, and why was it a bad idea, if I remember correctly?
So this was the copyright side of my work at Public Knowledge. SOPA was called, it's the Stop Online Piracy Act.
Sounds good in principle.
Yeah, no, it sounds good. It sounds great, right? It's a Solve All Problems on the Internet Act. And the problem with the mindset of many legislators, particularly kind of the older crowd, the folks who are less familiar with the internet, really have only heard about Napster from newspapers and never like seen, you know, they don't have college friends because they're, you know, much too old for that. Not understanding why people download content the way they do, and then believing that you can create a system of law and punishments and crimes to solve that problem. And even to the effect, so one of the biggest issues with SOPA was it would restructure the internet in such a way that would make it more vulnerable to hacking and identity theft and all sorts of cybersecurity issues that a number of prominent security experts, one of them, for example, is a gentleman named Dan Kaminsky, who I got to know during this campaign. He discovered like a fatal flaw that in terms of how the internet was structured, where but for his discovery and the companies quickly fixing it, it would have meant some catastrophic problems for the, you know, not just for the country, but for the world. And he's telling Congress, you know, this law you're designing to go after piracy is really weakening the internet, is going to make it something where people can't trust financial transactions or health transactions because you've compromised the system. In the name of, you know, all in the name of protecting kind of big Hollywood studios. And for what? I mean, at the end of the day, if they just provided more legal alternatives, you know, this was our policy argument. They needed to embrace Netflix and Hulu and other distribution platforms rather than fight the future. And that's how you're going to, you know, capture your revenues and expand your market and make money. Fast forward to today, that's exactly what they ended up doing. You look at Disney, they're launching their own Netflix product. Spotify is alive and well. China is one of their biggest markets, you know, in terms of movie studios. If you notice major productions nowadays, the big blockbusters have some sort of intent to launch in the Asian market, in terms of the content they put together now, because they understand that's where they really make a ton of money.
Sort of the Steve Jobs iTunes principle. If you make it legal and cheap, people will do the right thing.
The late Steve Jobs was absolutely right about the fact that if you don't teach people how to do it the legal way up front, they're going to learn how to do it illegally. And you can't fight consumer frustration and their willingness to get access to information they want to get access to.
Well, in the second half of the show, I want to ask you more specifically about the current fight in favor of net neutrality. But first, we have to take a short commercial break. Folks, I'm chatting with Electronic Frontier Foundation's Legislative Counsel, Ernesto Falcone. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Hi, this is John Marcellaro with the Mac Observer. This episode is brought to you by Jamf Now. Jamf Now helps you set up, manage, and protect your Apple devices on demand. We all know it's pretty easy to keep track of your own Mac, iPad, or iPhone, but what about the other Apple devices in your organization? As a business grows, so does its collection of devices, making it increasingly harder to manage everyone's iPad, iPhone, and Mac. This is especially true if employees are in different locations. So with Jamf Now, you can check real-time inventory, configure Wi-Fi and email settings, deploy applications, protect sensitive company data, and even lock or wipe your devices from anywhere. Jamf now manages and protects your devices so you can focus on your business instead, and no IT experience needed. All you Background Mode listeners can start securing your business today, setting up the first three devices for free forever. You can add more devices for just $2 a month per device. So create your own free account today at jamf.com/BGM. That's jamf.com/BGM. And now back to the show. I am chatting with Ernesto Falcone from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. So before we launch into the second half about the specifics of net neutrality, how about if you define that for us just to sort of set the stage?
Certainly. So the concept of net neutrality is, you know, you as the internet user should be allowed to go wherever you want on the internet and do whatever you want. And there isn't a gatekeeper or some sort of, party in the middle that would interfere with that for their own personal gain.
Okay. So recently we saw a Burger King enactment of how that works. You want your burger right now, you're going to pay a lot more than anybody else. And so that's a way to perhaps limit competition, especially in these days of services, or to extract more revenue and hurt the little guys. Is that all right?
You're right. I mean, I think in practice, what it looks like is it kind of depends on some of the markets you're in. So most Americans, a majority of Americans, have only one choice when it comes to high-speed internet. And so the ISPs know that. They know how capable their customers are to leaving their service. Mm-hmm. And they sell a service that's essential to life. You have to have broadband access today to be successful in really any sort of social or economic endeavor. So they know that. They know that you can't just abandon the service. And they know that they can kind of frustrate the consumer experience to increase rents, raise prices on someone else. Knowing that they are the end beneficiary at the end of the day. So I think what the Burger King ad gets right is, they know that it's going to be frustrating, and they know you can't really do much about it if you want that burger.
So what specifically did the recent FCC vote on that affected the net neutrality? Maybe people aren't quite certain about what specifically the FCC vote entailed and what it means.
Sure. So in 2015, effectively, the SEC kind of cleared the deck on what was its power to protect and a free and open internet. This was what's called the 2015 Open Internet Order. And
that was for Mr. Wheeler, who was head of the FCC then, right?
Yep. This is under Chairman Wheeler. This is essentially the legal foundation for net neutrality, requiring ISPs to once again operate in a non-discriminatory way.
Did the FCC really have the power to do that?
Yes, absolutely. It's a matter of fact that the internet started, the commercial internet started under Title II of the Communications Act, which is the Common Carrier Non-Discriminatory Rules. The beginning of broadband started under those type of rules. And it wasn't until about 2005 when the FCC started trending away from it, though at the same time argued that it had more than sufficient power to protect a free and open internet. So what Ajit Pai did, what the FCC chairman did really was a pretty grand departure. What he effectively has done is said we no longer have to require that the internet remain free and open as a matter of law, nor should the FCC be in the business of trying to ensure that outcome. We're going to let the industry, the major ISPs, handle it, and we will just hope for the best. I mean, it's really aspirations of policy without any sort of legal requirements or means of enforcing those protections.
What do you think the motivation behind that was? Was it in order to pass the issue off to Congress to properly deal with it? Or was it a blatant support of conservative principles in big business? Or was there some other reason why it was done? Because a million or two people said, no, we want net neutrality. It was ignored. So there must have been some compelling reason to overrule a couple million people's petitions.
Yeah, I mean, I think the rationale of the chairman is going to be up for dispute for many years. The public, as a matter of the polling and as a matter of just you just ask your friends and neighbors, you know, virtually none of them supported what the FCC did. The idea of the FCC had to do this in order to move the debate in Congress, you know, I think it's laughable in the sense that Congress is very divided. So that was that's an enormous gamble to take with the internet in hopes of the legislature suddenly coming together on this, particularly when you already had the protections in place in the first place. There's no reason to get rid of them. And I think that I think people who argue that this is a favor to AT&T, Verizon, Comcast are in the right to argue that, because they're really the only parties, the proponents of the repeal. Small ISPs across the country told the FCC to leave the Title II order alone. 2,000 small businesses wrote to the FCC opposing this decision, and millions of Americans.
I recall that Comcast made a statement that said they had no plans to disrupt net neutrality after that order was issued. Is that because they're still under the court's restrictions from the Universal acquisition, or was that just PR?
Yeah, definitely PR. I mean, the reality is Comcast, when it comes down to their litigation in court, do not want the law to require their network to operate in a non-discriminatory way. And even, taking Comcast specifically, when the FCC began to engage in this repeal, Comcast actually scrubbed their website of any sort of pledges to not engage in what's called pay prioritization. The process where they would ask certain, major internet companies to pay them extra money to get priority access to customers. So they obviously did that to make it legal, because they can't publicly say they're going to do one thing and then do the opposite as a business. They would actually be liable for lying to do that. You can't mislead people in that way. And so the best way to not get in trouble is just not publicly commit to doing the right thing in the first place.
So what organizations now and states have joined the fight against this ruling? Can you fill us in? Besides the EFF, and what's the EFF role?
So the main litigators from the consumer groups is Public Knowledge and Free Press. They've often are the main consumer groups that litigate in the telecom space. We'll probably file, we will definitely be involved in the litigation, but not as litigants, but probably in a much more supportive role.
Friends of the... Mm-hmm. What do you call it?
Yeah, it's an amicus filings, friends of the petitioners.
Right.
We haven't decided quite how we're going to do that, but I think it's probably similar to what we did in the 2015 litigation, which was bring a lot of the engineers into the discussion. The Internet Association, which represents the large internet companies, is also suing, as well as a couple dozen state attorney generals are suing the FCC. So.
What do you think the prospects are of those lawsuits?
It's not a slam dunk for the FCC in the first place to win on this. I don't know where I would necessarily weight the percentage. It just depends on which issues are being debated. I would say the FCC is not in great shape when there's lots of factual information to run contrary to their decision and their justifications, and that's usually not a good thing. Unless their justifications have equal value and equal weight. And the problem is when the FCC would tell people that the ISPs are disinvesting from the networks network investment was harmed from regulation. That's a pretty easy thing to assess by the numbers. Mm-hmm. And not only have the heads of these corporations told their investors that there was no real harm to the companies from regulation, the last couple of years, but that business was booming. They're on record for saying that. And then there's two pretty major studies, one by Free Press and the other by the Internet Association, showing just how much more money they were investing in the networks during the Title II post 2015. And demonstrated there was no decrease, right? The truth is the exact opposite of what the chairman issued as his narrative.
I think one state, maybe wrong, but I recall Montana said that if you're going to do business in our state, you must comply with net neutrality rules. Can the states get away with that, given the structure of the internet?
Yes, I definitely think that the states, Montana, New York, and New Jersey, actually have all kind of engaged in the premise that if taxpayer money is being spent on ISPs, we can ask for a neutral network in return for that product. I think states are perfectly empowered to make choices as the kind of purchasers of services. It gets a little tougher for the states to get involved in the direct regulation of ISPs in the same way the FCC has been involved, but it's not impossible. It's just a matter of how the state kind of sets up the protections. Ultimately, while EFF is fully supportive of every state doing what they can to protect network neutrality, ultimately, final resolution will have to happen back in D.C. It will need to be restoration of the network neutrality rules. And at least right now, there's a vote that's pending this year on reversing the FCC. That's going to go to before the United States Senate, in a few months, and then hopefully before the House of Representatives thereafter.
Interesting. Interesting. So there are also some big companies that are fighting this FCC ruling. Can you talk about who some of the biggest players are and what maybe they may be able to do to contribute to a solution?
Well, so the biggest companies are fighting against the repeal, you mean?
Yeah. No. Fighting against the repeal. I read that Google was trying to reverse this decision by the FCC and AGIPAI.
Yes, yeah. So they're all kind of consolidated under their association called the Internet Association.
Okay.
And so that'll
that's
be
the vehicle they use.
Yes, that'll be where they all contribute money to the association. So the association hires lawyers to litigate on behalf of all the companies. And they're all lock-synced on reversing the FCC. The interesting thing is the largest companies will be fine in the sense that they have the money available to pay the extra rents to Comcast, AT&T, Verizon. Philosophically, I think they all remember their startup days. They're not that old as companies. It's really the small business, the small startup, the mom and pop, the new person who launches a product online. They're the ones that really lose out, because at the end of the day, they have no leverage. They have no way to go to a big company like Comcast and demand equal and fair treatment absent the law. And they're the ultimate ones that are at most at risk if the FCC's decision carries forward.
What do you think the prospects are for somebody who's a very large company merging together, not merging, but working together with another large company, say Apple and Microsoft or something like that, to build a new Internet 3? Is there any talk of that?
So the challenges for them is the challenge for anyone to build a competitive alternative right now in the market is they face a lot of barriers. Many of those barriers are erected by the incumbents. There is a reason why Google Fiber is no longer building in new cities. There's a reason why Verizon Fios has stopped investing long ago. And it's a combination of things. It's a combination of local cities have to kind of take the charge a little bit more aggressively to inject competition. But really, when the federal regulatory policy is looking at the status of competition and think we don't have to do anything about it, as this chairman has done, release the protections that consumers have relied on in hopes of monopolies not acting monopolistically. We have a really big problem with the backwards thinking in communications law.
Are we seeing any short-term effects of any of the carriers, Verizon, Comcast, et cetera, taking any affirmative action to do some of the things that are allowed now, or they're sort of holding back, waiting to see how the court cases go?
So what's going to happen for that is they have contracts signed with all the major content distributors, like Netflix, for example. So right now, as a matter of state contract law, they can't really change the game. Once those contracts expire, though, they will negotiate based on the premise of what the law allows them to ask for and withhold. And I think that's when we're going to see some real serious disruptions in what we traditionally have not had to deal with as internet users. Companies leveraging their assets against others in demands of paying higher and higher fees, which then get passed on to customers. We haven't seen that world yet, and it won't be immediate. It'll be probably in the coming years.
Who who assigns the chairmanship of the FCC? Is that subject to reversal by Congress, or does the president make that assignment? Who votes that chairman in?
So the president appoints the chair, and then the United States Senate votes in confirmation, whether they consent or not. And Ajit Pai was actually reconfirmed about 6 or 7 months ago. Majority of Democratic senators voted against him, but a handful voted in favor. And this was all before, you know, leading up to the December decision, which, you know, I think if you had that vote today, it might be very different.
Okay. All right, so we're about out of time. What did I not ask that I should have asked?
Well, the other thing besides net neutrality that's very important out there for the internet user is restoring our privacy rights. People are feeling like they have, you know, no control about how their information is treated. And part of that loss of control is the fact that these companies have undermined or eliminated the law that protected their rights. In the terms of what happened in December at the SEC, that decision wasn't just net neutrality. It was competition. It was also privacy. All of the privacy obligations of cable and telephone companies was eliminated as well. And
is this privacy with respect to handling account information, or is this technical, having to do with internet traffic and certificates and so on?
More so the effect of what can they do with third parties and to monetize the information they collect about you when you okay. The law has been structured where they had to get your permission first before using your personal information with third parties. Now that doesn't apply. They don't need your permission. They just need to tell you what they're doing. And that's kind of the end of it.
Wow. Are there lawsuits pending on that situation as well?
Well, in effect, the lawsuits that reverse the FCC decision are part and parcel the same. Reversing the FCC decision on net neutrality will also restore our privacy protections.
Okay. So finally, what can consumers do practically besides donate money to the EFF? Or is there a better way? Is another organization they can support or donate money to?
Well, definitely any of the organizations you see leading kind of a campaign on this front are worthy of support. And EFF support, we appreciate all of our donors that we get.
Public Knowledge, the Internet Foundation, and you guys, right?
Well, and Free Press and Public Knowledge, ACLU is also involved in this space. But the most important thing I would want to convey to your listeners is contacting your local government, your member of Congress, and your state representation about this issue is probably the most important thing to do right now. If the elected officials feel that their voters are in a specific place on this issue, that helps. That helps me when I do my lobbying work on behalf of my EFF membership, because then they think, oh, a lot of people care, and I have to do something about this.
Okay. All right, so we're going to have to wrap it up. Thank you so much for joining me and clarifying all these issues. It was a lot of information. I think that's helpful to the listeners to understand the situation and what's being done about it. So thanks again for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Yeah, feel free to just, I am available by email, just ernesto@eff.org. We're publicly listed on eff.org. Follow our blog and take action when the issues are hot.
All right, great. Well, thanks again, folks. I hope you enjoyed listening to Ernesto Falcone from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and we'll be back next week with another edition of the Mac Observer's Background Mode. Mm-hmm.